Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our study on the book of Esther. One of the reasons that I wanted to do the book of Esther, for those of you who haven't been with us maybe in the last couple of programs, is its accent on the providence of God. Even though the name of God is not mentioned, I pointed out that that is the whole idea. The providence of God is a term that describes that hidden hand of our sovereign God, whereby God works his plan and carries out his purpose, not directly by miracles, by the demonstrable exercise of the supernatural, but through means. Those means being other human beings, non-human means, things that we would never suspect, all play in to God's achieving his purpose. The book of Esther is sometimes said to be an etiological document. An etiological document is one that accounts for the origins of things and supposed to account for the origin of the Feast of Purim. It does that. That is true as far as it goes. But the Feast of Purim really celebrates, whether it was meant to or not, it celebrates the providence of God in the way it saved the Jewish people from an intended genocide. There's more value to the book of Esther than just that, though that is our accent in tracing the hidden hand of God through this book. But another value of the book of Esther is that it is not only a pattern of the way God's sovereign providence works, not only in this case, but works today. The same God works in our lives today. It gives us a better appreciation for that. But it also is a model and a template of the redemptive hand of God in saving his people, not only the Jewish people throughout times when they face so many threats, and in more recent times, but especially the redemptive hand of God in the end times, in saving all of his people, Jew or Gentile, from the hostile intentions of the world. This is a microcosm of that. It's a type, a pattern, a foreshadowing of the macrocosm. So there's a lot that is of interest to us as contemporary believers back in the book of Esther. We started out introducing the book of Esther and then telling the story in brief in our first program. In our last program, we amplified part of the story dealing with the first chapter of the book of Esther. Now, today, we will pick up the narrative, go on into chapter 2, and begin to point out as we move along the hidden hand of God in all of these things. What we have in the first chapter is an account of King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's known in the book of Esther. The time frame of this story is 483 B.C. to 473 B.C. The king, probably in planning his campaign against the Greeks during that time, a famous campaign in Greek history, put on a great confab for all of his high-ranking officers, civilian and military, lasted for about a half a year, but came down, climaxed in a great banquet, both for the men and the women, the queen hosting the latter, and he displayed his royal glory, magnifying himself and his kingdom in the eyes of all of his servants. And at the end of the time, he just let the wine flow, and these people were probably quite stoned. When the king, probably a little tipsy himself, got the idea of inviting Queen Vashti, who was evidently a renowned beauty, in to be ogled at by this crowd of drunks. The text doesn't say it, but you have to ask why the queen refused to come, and we speculated, I don't like to indulge in that, but it is a question that begs to be asked, why would she not want to come? All the king wanted to do is just come in and show the men just how gorgeous she was. There'd probably be some whistles and some oohs and ahs. Why would the queen refuse that? Wouldn't any woman like to be admired like that? But most likely what he wanted her to do was come in very skimpily dressed, or perhaps even in a nude with only a crown on her head, and display that fabulous figure she must have had and that extraordinarily beautiful face. And the queen stood on her dignity and said, "Absolutely not. I'll not go in before a house of drunks like that." I am quite sure in my own mind that was what happened. Well, that was an insult to the king, of course, but it had ramifications far beyond that. If the queen of the realm could face the king down and say, "No way, Jose," everybody saw the obvious implications for that in domestic order throughout the realm. So the king did a smart thing. Anybody does a smart thing. He consulted with what we today might call his cabinet, his advisors, and one of them suggested that Vashti needed to be deposed, and deposed she was, for not only the insult that she gave to the king and for the king's royal dignity, but also so that other women would not take their cues from Vashti and begin to say, "Well, the queen did it. I'm tired of this guy telling me what I ought to do, so I will rebel also." And so they deposed Vashti, and letters were sent to that effect to all the king's provinces. Well, we move to chapter 2, and there is a time gap in chapter 2, moves forward for several years from 483 to 479 B.C., probably after the king's return from his Greek campaign. We don't know for sure, but that's most likely. We read in verse 1 of chapter 2 that after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And evidently, he was conferencing about that with his advisors, as usual. Smart thing to do. You always get better results when you get more than one mind, one good mind, involved. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "You know, I think the best idea is to let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers," they suggested, "in all the provinces of his kingdom, and let them gather, let them harvest every beautiful young virgin," translate that marriage candidate, "to the capital here in Susa. Let's induct them into the harem." They would thereby become concubines, which would mean they were a secondary wife, "and place them in the custody of Haggai." That's not the biblical prophet Haggai, but H-E-G-A-I, Haggai, the king's eunuch. They always had eunuchs in charge of the women. That way you got no hanky-panky. "And let them be glamorized," is the idea in verse 3. "Let cosmetics be given to them." They had their ways of making women beautiful in their day, just as modern women have their own processes and other means and measures to make them more beautiful than they naturally are in our day. "So let their cosmetics be given to them so they can present their best face," especially to the king. And the suggestion went on further, "Let the young lady, out of all of these candidates, who most pleases the king, let her be queen in place of Vashti." And that advice pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now, in all of this, we see the providential hand of God. God, we said, is omniscient. I think most of you know the meaning of that word. It means that God knows all things. He knows the past, he knows the present, and he knows the future. And I know that there are questions involved with all these things, which, as I said, in the course of this study, I have neither the time nor the inclination to try to address. In fact, there are some issues that we can't address. We must just recognize they go beyond the capacity of human rationality to deal with. They're not irrational. They're suprarational. They're just beyond the reach of human reason. God knows all things, and he knows what his great enemy and our great enemy, Satan, was planning as a way of destroying the Jewish people. And already God has an effect, though it's not evident at the human level. Humans don't even know what is going on. But God already has a plan in place as a countermeasure. And though it was not known to anybody, in this whole incident with Vashti, there was a plan in place. And let me say, God's plans are very complex. It's not as if God is working one thing at a time. not to trivialize divine processes which are beyond our comprehension. God has many balls in the air at one time, and his purposes are complex and they're multiple. But in all of this, one purpose was to set up the situation providentially so that Esther would come to the throne. And that happens with this incident in the king staging this big banquet, getting drunk. God didn't make him get drunk. He chose to get drunk, but God used that and used his bad judgment at the time to order Vashti to come in, skimpily clad, at least I would think, and then to find in that a reason to have her deposed. Well, now we see things working out so that Esther is going to become queen. It's not clear in the narrative yet, but that's the way it's going to work out. So we're down to verse 4 of chapter 2, where the king is pleased. He settled on the fact that, okay, I'm back from my campaign, we need a queen here. That's what everybody is saying. They have a plan. How do you get a queen? Well, they went out, as I say, and they harvested all the virgin beauties of the realm. They're going to bring them in, and they're going, we might say, to have a horse show. Now, we are told in verse 5 that there was a Jew in Susa the capital. His name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Now, we're told all of this because it becomes significant in the story. This Mordecai was of the family of Saul, and he was no ordinary person. He had a pedigree. He had some standing, some cachet as a descendant of the royal family, not of David, but of King Saul. That is the reason that we find Mordecai well-placed. We don't know his position, but he was always hanging around the palace gates, and they just didn't allow any John or any Joe to hang out there. So he was a man of some influence. That's not a royal counselor by any stretch, but he was not a person of a mean position. Already, I want you to see that God had Mordecai in a place where he is at advantage in what happens, though Mordecai doesn't know he's going to need that advantage. We are also told that Mordecai had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah. That happened in 598-97 B.C. in the first invasion of Babylon, which made Judah a subject state, but it was not the great destruction of Jerusalem. That didn't come until 586 B.C. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was the one, the king of Babylon, who had taken them back there. Then the Persians conquered the Babylonians and inherited all the exiles. We're told in verse 7 of chapter 2 that Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, whose other name was Esther, and that she was an orphan. And even in that, the circumstance of Esther being an orphan caused Mordecai to take her under his care. That's all providential, because they're all going to be players in this drama. And it's not just a human drama, it is a divine drama. And notice that. He was bringing up Hadassah, verse 7, chapter 2, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So that means he's an older cousin. For she had neither father or mother. All a circumstance of divine providence. It's not a kind situation to be without father or mother. But God has a purpose, and his higher purpose for this young woman's life, Esther, was greater than the advantage of having a father or mother. God has a right to do with us what he chooses to do, and his purposes are always greater than whatever our personal little dreams may be. And that was the case here. But Esther had no idea of this. There's also another circumstance that Esther was favored with. She was beautiful of form and face. She was a gorgeous girl. If she hadn't been a gorgeous girl, this thing would never have happened. Beauty is a nice thing. Most of the time, it's an asset. Sometimes it can be a liability, depending on other circumstances. But in this case, it was a great asset. And God is going to use her natural beauty of face and form to launch her into a position where she will be humanly speaking, one of the saviors of the Jewish people, and what terrible thing is about to happen. Well, when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. He adopted her, took her under his wing. So when it came about, verse 8, that the command and the decree of the king were heard, and many of these young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, into the custody of Haggai, well, wouldn't you know, this is the providence of God, that Esther was taken to the king's palace in the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. Verse 9, now the young lady pleased him. God gave her not only beauty of face and form, but he gave her a spirit. He gave her a style. He gave her an attitude that very much pleased this important player in the drama, Haggai. He favored her. She found favor with him. This is God's hidden hand at work. God is never mentioned. And God is never mentioned because, my friends, in so many of the things that God does, there is no thought of God. There is no sight of the hand of God. It's a hidden hand, but it's a very real hand, and it is the dominant hand, not only in their situation, but in ours today. So Esther found favor, and he quickly, Haggai, this eunuch in charge of the women, he provided her with her cosmetics and food. He gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. In other words, he's giving her every advantage possible to prepare her for the day when she is called in to be with the king. Now, we notice in verse 10, this is very important, the hidden hand of God, God's providence. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred. She didn't tell anybody that she was a Jewess. And the reason she didn't at the human level was Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. It wasn't because Mordecai saw what was coming. This was God. But at the human level, Mordecai had trained sensibilities, and he knew that it was not always an advantage to be a Jew, that there was anti-Semitism in the air in that day, heavy duty, just as there is in our day, sometimes heavy duty. So he had a talk with her, and he says, Esther, I don't want your ethnicity to be a disadvantage to you in the higher circles of the court. So best, dear, just to leave that out of your resume. And she was compliant. Well, Mordecai, like an interested father, though he was not really her father, he walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem. He always wanted to know how Esther was and how she fared. And apparently he had, as I pointed out, enough clout, though he was not a big deal, in the realm, he had enough clout, he had enough influence to gather the intelligence that he needed. And all we need to know here is that Mordecai was in touch. God had placed him in a position where he was not cut off from all communication channels into the palace. He could get information, and that would be very important. Well, we read in verse 12 that when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months of beauty treatments, 12 months under the regulations for the women, days for their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices, and the cosmetics for the women. I don't know how all those differ from what women do today. Pardon me, I'm a man. Pretty sure nobody's using oil of myrrh, but hey, I don't know. Well, whatever young lady it was, that virgin would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. I assume that those things may have been calculated for sex appeal or whatever. That was just the bold truth. So in the evening she would go in, and whoever she was, in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. They were now officially wives of the king. She would not go in again to the king unless the king called for her. She was summoned by name. Well, in verse 15, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, when her time to go in to the king came around, she took Haggai's advice. She didn't request anything. except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who favored her, was in charge of the women, advised, and he would be a good source of counsel. So Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. She was not a beautiful but spoiled woman, not a beautiful but narcissistic woman all into herself, not one with whom it was all about her. She had a spirit that was about as beautiful as she was in face and form. So Esther was taken in to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. That would be 479 B.C., December. The king loved Esther more than all the women. She found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins who had been selected as potential queen candidates. So she won the prize. He set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. All of this advice and all of this preparation of Haggai. Haggai didn't know God from a bunny rabbit. Nevertheless, he was a man that God had placed there, and he was a man in whose eyes Esther gained favor. And God had prepared Esther in such a way that she would gain favor. All of this is the hidden hand of God. God working behind the scenes, working through various means, none of which seem significant in the grand scheme of things. But nevertheless, they turn out to be significant. And Esther is the one who, I say, won the prize. And then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all of his princes and his servants. And he also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. And he gave Esther great stature as his new queen. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. We are reminded in verse 20 that Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, just as Mordecai, we are reminded, had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. God had prepared the heart of this woman, prepared the habits of this woman, and that's so fortunate, because just as she was subservient to the king, she was also subservient to her older cousin, who had adopted her as his very own. Had that not been the case, things would not have turned out as they did. So things are taking the shape the Lord wants them to take, yet the name of God is never mentioned. Well, we are told in verses 21 through 23 at the end of chapter 2 that in those days, while Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, again, that's a position of influence. Perhaps not the greatest influence, but it's one which gives him, if not insider status, it gives him access to the inside. It gives him communication channels, but has also put him in position to hear the gossip, almost like Washington. While Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, two characters, one Bigthan and the other by the name of Teresh, they were two of the king's officials who guarded the door. Ooh, that's dangerous if they're angry people. Well, these two guys became angry, and they sought to assassinate him. The plot became known to Mordecai. He passed the information along on the inside to Esther through servants. Esther informed the king, and she did it in Mordecai's name. Ah, that's big. She just didn't go in and tell the king. She did it. She didn't know how significant this would be, but did it in Mordecai's name. The plot was investigated, found to be on the level, and they hang both on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. And that was a providential touch, as we will see. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.